You can't fight the enemy with his own ring without turning into an enemy.
Nice. Jared Tolkien himself.
Two, chapter 10, The Breaking of the Fellowship. The final chapter of The Fellowship of the Ring.
I know. Oh, I'm so... This is a moment. See, I'm really feeling it now. Like, in Fellowship, when we finished it, I don't know if I was really feeling it. Here, I'm feeling it. Like, this is a bigger milestone for me than finishing Fellowship. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Maybe because we're, like, halfway through the show now.
Some say this is an anticlimactic chapter. Do you... After reading this, do you feel... You feel that way, or you think there's quite a bit that's coming to a head?
I think this is definitely a phase change, but I think we should go through it and we can address that at the end.
Okay.
What do you think, really quick? Don't give a full explanation.
Yeah, I won't. But I think this is actually more climactic than it gets credit for.
Yeah, I think so too. I agree. Obviously, we got to cover the whole breaking of the fellowship. So, what causes it? Well, Frodo and Boromir have quite the confrontation, and then Frodo goes and gets a pretty good outlook of literally everything that's going on in Middle-earth. So we got to talk about that, and we got to talk about what the rest of the Fellowship is thinking, and we got to talk about Frodo leaving and a certain other hobbit who's extremely loyal and goes with him. Oh, and we got to talk about drafts. And we're, just for fun, we're going to power rank our top five chapters at the end. So If you want to stay tuned for that part, whatever. So this episode, it might be longer than it looks, like, because we got a bunch of crap towards the back.
Yeah, but in our defense, yeah. This is the last book, or last chapter of the book, rather.
Yeah. Before all that, Cliff's notes.
So, the company disembarks at a clearing off the west side of the river, just below Amon Hen. They pass a quiet but uneasy night. Aragorn senses danger close, but not too close, at hand. The next morning, they convene, recognizing that they can delay their decisions no longer. Frodo leaves the others to think over the weighty decision, while the others remain at camp. On his way up Amon Hen, he reflects, but is interrupted by Boromir, who starts friendly, but quickly turns to anger. Frodo flees, wearing the ring, only to see greater threats. Meanwhile, the company gets anxious, and when an ashamed and suspicious Boromir returns to camp, they split off to look frantically for Frodo. In the commotion, Frodo returns to the boats and pulls away to the eastern shore, but not before Sam joins him.
Nice.
So efficient. I'm so efficient, Patrick. Left me hanging.
Well, did you not see that I pointed.
I was busy engaged in the story, not worrying about which beer you're on.
Okay, full disclosure. While Clifford read that, I didn't listen at all. I went to grab another drink, and I got back in time. So
no, actually,
whatever.
I'm faster than you think I am. So they pull off the river, and what do you make of it? Seems like it's good, but things are tense.
Yeah, I thought this would make peaceful times. This would make a cool picnic spot. That's all I always think about when they are on this landing at Amon Hen.
Yeah, it's like this perfect last clearing before the river pours over the falls, right?
Yeah, and you got the cool sound of the waterfall the whole chapter.
And it's right in front of the three mountains.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so yeah, so let's just fly through some detail stuff. So Frodo's on watch at the night, and Aragorn, obviously he's not sleeping. Classic Aragorn,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Pretty sure he's only slept a couple hours so far in the story.
Right. They take out Sting, and they see that it is gleaming at the edges, which would mean orcs are close, but not too close, and they're hoping they're just on the other side of the river, mm-hmm, and not on their side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
TBD.
And Aragorn sort of feels that something's amiss, right?
He has that sense the entire chapter. That's pretty important to remember, especially going forward.
Yeah, and we haven't really gotten an explanation for this before, but it's been mentioned before that Aragorn has this... It's like he's got this sixth sense for what's going on, right? We know he's a really good tracker.
Yeah, the Rangers are just good with the wild. Okay. Like they're in their element.
Okay.
So then Aragorn says in a really epic way, but we don't have time to read it, okay, it's finally time to choose... Do we go with Boromir to Gondor and the wars that are down there? Or do we go east to Fear and Shadow? Or we could all just go separate ways, different ways. And Aragorn says, Frodo, choice is yours. It's on you. I've tried to fill Gandalf's shoes, but they're way too big for me to fill. But even if he was here, I'm not sure he would have an answer for you either. So you got to go decide. Mm-hmm. And Frodo says, how about one more hour? Let me just think alone. And... Aragorn grants it. Sam has that good line. You want to read that line?
Plain as a pikestaff it is, but it's no good Sam Gamgee putting in his spoke just now.
That wasn't that great a line. So there's hints that Sam thinks that the choice is pretty obvious, but we'll find out more about that later. And then Boromir's also eyeing Frodo as he leaves.
Right. And it may be that Frodo thinks the choice is obvious too, and he just is having trouble coming to it.
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens here. So Frodo's walking aimlessly up through the ruins that are at the spot, because this used to be a kind of a hangout spot with the men of Gondor, mm-hmm. especially because this is the Hill of Seeing, and then across the water is the Hill of Hearing.
Mm-hmm. These are the guard posts that formed the northern border of Gondor in its glory days.
Yeah, yeah. And so then there was a quote, he sat down upon the stone and cupped his chin in his hands, staring eastward, seeing little with his eyes. All that had happened since Bilbo left the Shire was passing through his mind, and he recalled and pondered everything that he could remember of Gandalf's words. Time went on, and still he was no nearer to a choice.
Mm-hmm. It sounds a little bit like he's looking for a sign. You know, he's searching his memory. Can he find insight, advice, or counsel in anything from the past and anything Gandalf has said to him? Like, maybe there's some advice buried in there that he's looking for.
Or he just needs impetus to finally pick away.
Right.
It's not so much even wisdom here. It's just, all right, give me something that just forces me to mm-hmm. just do it. You know, jump in either way. Mm-hmm.
Which is actually, it's reminiscent of Aragorn a few chapters back suggesting that he really wanted to take the river down to Amon Hen because there he might see a sign that would help him make a decision as well.
Yeah, we'll see. It's this chapter, man. This is it. or arguably maybe future events that I don't want to spoil.
But nevertheless, we could surmise that there's some significance to being on this Hill of Seeing. Both Aragorn and Frodo supposedly are looking for some sort of unexplained sign. We don't really know what kind or where they're looking. But they're looking for some sort of sign to help with their decision making. And they happen to be at the Hill of Seeing. To me, it's too much to be a coincidence.
Well, I don't want to keep getting in the weeds of this. Okay. But yeah, I get what you're going at. Okay, so Boromir does show up though. Convenient or not convenient. Apparently he says he doesn't want Frodo to be alone, but it seems more importantly he wants a one-on-one chat with him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of debating with everybody there, like, let's just get down to brass tacks and decide together one-on-one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You want to take Frodo? I'll be Boromir.
You're kind, answered Frodo, but I do not think that any speech will help me, for I know what I should do, but I'm afraid of doing it, Boromir. Afraid.
Boromir stood silent. Rauros roared endlessly on. The wind murmured in the branches of the trees. Frodo shivered. Suddenly Boromir came and sat beside him. Are you sure that you do not suffer needlessly? He said. I wish to help you. You need counsel in this hard choice. Will you not take mine?
I think I know already what counsel you would give, Boromir, said Frodo, and it would seem like wisdom, but for the warning of my heart.
Warning? Warning against what? Said Boromir sharply.
Against delay. Against the way that seems easier. Against refusal of the burden that is laid on me. Against... Well, if it must be said, against trust in the strength and truth of men.
Yet that strength has long protected you far away in your little country, though you knew it not.
I do not doubt the valor of your people, but the world is changing. The walls of Minas Tirith may be strong, but they are not strong enough. If they fail, what then?
We shall fall in battle valiantly. Yet there is still hope that they will not fail.
No hope while the ring lasts, said Frodo.
Ah, the ring, said Boromir, his eyes lighting. The ring, the ring. Is it not such a strange fate that we should suffer so much fear and doubt for so small a thing? So small a thing. And I have only seen it for an instant in the House of Elrond. Could I not have a sight of it again?
Frodo looked up. His heart went suddenly cold. He caught the strange gleam in Boromir's eyes, yet his face was still kind and friendly. It is best that it should lie hidden, he answered.
As you wish, I care not, said Boromir. Yet may I not even speak of it? For you seem ever to think only of its power in the hands of the enemy, of its evil uses, not of its good. The world is changing, you say. Minas Tirith will fall if the ring lasts. But why? Certainly, if the ring were with the enemy. But why, if it were with us?
Were you not at the council? Answered Frodo. Because we cannot use it, and what is done with it turns to evil.
Boromir got up and walked about impatiently. So you go on, he cried. Gandalf, Elrond, all these folk have taught you to say so. For themselves, they may be right. These elves and half-elves and wizards, they would come to grief, perhaps. Yet often I doubt if they are wise and not merely timid, but each to his own kind. True-hearted men, they will not be corrupted. We of Minas Tirith have been staunch through long years of trial. We do not desire the power of wizard lords, only strength to defend ourselves, strength in a just cause. And behold, in our need, chance brings to light the ring of power. It is a gift, I say, a gift to the foes of Mordor. It is mad not to use it, to use the power of the enemy against him, the fearless and the ruthless. These alone will achieve victory. What could not a warrior do in this hour? A great leader. What could not Aragorn do? Or, if he refuses, why not Boromir? The ring would give me power of command. How I would drive the host of Mordor, and all the men would flock to my banner. So, just a quick pause here. Very important to remember, the ring is a modern concept. You know, this is based on modern ideas of, like, the corruption. Like, absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? That's, mm-hmm. We've gone over this before, that's a modern idea.
Mm-hmm.
This, we're definitely seeing with Boromir here. It's coming out that he was never totally on board with destroying the ring. He thinks the fellowship should have used it, and this is what's going to cause the breaking of the fellowship. He thinks that true men / brave men or real men, good men, strong men, however you want to put it, won't be corrupted.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of laughable in the grand scheme of things, because men are probably the most corruptible, but whatever. Anyways, Tom Shippey has the good quote when he's going over this in his Author of the Century book. Boromir's speech sends out all the signals which the 20th century has learned to distrust, from the fascination with power, even if it's the power of the enemy, to the exaltation of the fearless, and then immediately the ruthless as a means of victory. Finally, the self-dramatization of himself as the leader with the power to command and the naked appeal to force. But with that said, let's keep going.
Okay. Just wanted to note how Boromir starts out insidious almost. You know, I think we take cue from his very first words. Are you sure that you do not suffer needlessly? I wish to help you. You need counsel. Why don't you take mine? I feel like aspects of that have been ingrained in, we almost have like an aversion to that phrasing that even I feel like a child could start to recognize, like the kind of predatory nature of that.
I agree, but he might not even realize he's doing that part himself. Like, I think that might actually be genuine. But I would save that idea for after we get through this whole part, because we'll discuss the whole thing. Yeah, so Boromir goes on and he says, "And they tell us to throw it away," he cried. "I do not say destroy it. That might be well, if reason could show any hope of doing so. It does not. The only plan that is proposed to us is that a halfling should walk blindly into Mordor and offer the enemy every chance of recapturing it himself. Folly. Surely you see it, my friend," he said, turning now suddenly to Frodo again. "You say that you are afraid. If it is so, the boldest should pardon you. But is it not your good sense that revolts?"
"No, I'm afraid," said Frodo. "Simply afraid. But I'm glad to have heard you speak so fully. My mind is clearer now."
"Then you will come to Minas Tirith?" cried Boromir. His eyes were shining and his face was eager.
"You misunderstand me," said Frodo.
Okay, so this is big too. So, what are we seeing right here?
Well, Frodo has clearly made up his decision. Right. And this is maybe symbolic of this. This is like a turning point in the conversation, at least, where Frodo has gone from unsure of himself and hesitant and Boromir very assertive, to where Boromir has kind of driven himself into a frenzy and has suddenly become the less mature one in the conversation.
Right. We just saw Boromir talking about, like, well, what if I had the ring? I would be a great commander and everything like that.
Yeah,
right?
allow me to give you counsel in my wisdom. Yeah. All of a sudden, it's Frodo is holding the line of, like, no, I have a decision and you do not understand what I'm talking about because you're kind of you're driven. You've driven yourself mad.
Yeah. At this point, Fleming Rutledge has this good quote in her book, Battle for Middle Earth. She says, what Frodo sees in Boromir gives him insight that he did not have before. He sees grandiosity and hubris, the overweening self-importance that proves fatal in any created being. It is not Boromir's reasoning that alerts Frodo to the danger of his proposal. It is Boromir's pride. Frodo is thus able to resist when his much larger companion puts forth his seductive arguments. All right, going on with the thing. Boromir keeps going. He says, "But will you come, at least for a while?" Boromir persisted. "My city is not far now, and it is little further from there to Mordor than from here. We have long been in the wilderness, and you need news of what the enemy is doing before you can make a move. Come with me, Frodo," he said. "You need to rest before your venture. If go, you must." He laid his hand on the hobbit's shoulder in friendly fashion, but Frodo felt the hand trembling with suppressed excitement. He stepped quickly away and eyed, with alarm, the tall man, nearly twice his height and many times his match in strength. "Why are you so unfriendly?" said Boromir. "I am a true man, neither thief nor tracker. I need your ring, that you know now, but I give you my word that I do not desire to keep it. Will you not at least let me make trial of my plan? Lend me the ring."
"No, no," cried Frodo. "The council laid it upon me to bear it."
"It is by your own folly that the enemy will defeat us," cried Boromir. "How it angers me. Fool, obstinate fool, running willfully to death and ruining our cause. If any mortals have claim to the ring, it is the men of Numenor, and not halflings. It is not yours, save by unhappy chance. It might have been mine. It should be mine. Give it to me."
Frodo did not answer, but moved away till the great flat stone stood between them.
"Come, come, my friend," said Boromir in a softer voice. "Why not get rid of it? Why not just be free of your doubt and fear? You can lay blame on me, if you will. You can say that I was too strong and took it by force, for I am too strong for you, halfling," he cried.
And suddenly he sprang over the stone and leapt at Frodo. His fair and pleasant face was hideously changed. A raging fire was in his eyes. Frodo dodged aside and again put the stone between them. There was only one thing he could do. Trembling, he pulled out the ring upon its chain and quickly slipped it on his finger, even as Boromir sprang at him again. The man gasped, stared for a moment amazed, and then ran wildly about, seeking here and there among the rocks and trees.
"Miserable trickster," he shouted. "Let me get my hands on you. Now I see your mind. You will take the ring to Sauron and sell us all. You have only waited for your chance to leave us in a lurch. Curse you and all the halflings to death and darkness."
Then, catching his foot on a stone, he fell sprawling and lay upon his face. For a while, he was as still as if his own curse had struck him down. Then suddenly, he wept. He rose and passed his hand over his eyes, dashing away the tears.
"What have I said?" he cried. "What have I done? Frodo! Frodo!" he called. "Come back. A madness took me, but it is past. Come back."
There was no answer. Frodo did not even hear his cries.
Oh, okay, so that was pretty big.
Definitely.
All right, let's see. Where should we start here? Why don't we start with Boromir's character himself?
Yeah. Ultimately, do you feel like Boromir is being reasonable here or completely unreasonable?
Well, so I would say...
Because we've discussed him in the past that although he differs in opinion from everybody else, it's actually pretty reasonable the way he sees everything. He's waging a war against Mordor, against Sauron, and his goal is to defend his people. And right. There is a weapon at hand that could be very useful, and that's all he knows.
So yeah, so I think this chapter can leave a lot of people with a salty taste in their mouth about Boromir. Like, they think he just sucks, he just ruins them, and people don't like
mm-hmm.
him permanently, right? But I think what you're saying is true. Because we have to remember, sure, this whole time he's been loud and pretty proud mm-hmm. about himself, mm-hmm. but that's just kind of by his nature. And also, like, the pride, he kind of lives up to it. Like, he's actually been useful on this journey, and he has been a good guy. It's highlighted every conflict that's arisen, especially between him and Aragorn for the whole trip. But we could probably safely assume he was getting along well with them for the rest of it.
Yeah, and not to mention, in this section, he actually pointed out that Aragorn could use the ring, and if not Aragorn, then Boromir.
Right.
So he's at least on the surface, he's suggesting that it's the premise of using the ring as a weapon first and not giving himself power.
Yeah, and then like you've said, the whole time, his biggest goal has been to defend his people. And his people right now, they really are, they're facing down pure evil. Like, this is literally, the orcs and stuff are a very, 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 very evil army. Like, Sauron is literally the right-hand man to Satan. Like, he was the right-hand man to Satan, and now he's the guy in charge. And this is the army that they're facing down. It's not just, like, it's evil men that they're demonizing for their propaganda purposes. It's like, no, I mean, there's just no way around it. Orcs want bad stuff. You know, like, they have evil intentions, pure evil intentions, right? And also, here's an interesting point. Again, this is from Fleming Rutledge's book, and I don't know. I haven't heard this before. Okay, yes, Boromir spent 2 months in Rivendell. And yes, he spent, at this point, 2 months traveling the Fellowship, about, you know, give or take.
Right.
But in all his days of war back in Gondor, where would he have learned, or who would have taught him, the idea that if you use the weapons of the enemy, you become the enemy yourself? That's not really instinctive for him to know.
Right.
That's why you can't use the ring, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's because you can't use evil means to fight evil,
right,
or else you become evil yourself.
Right.
But we've already heard hints that the wisdom of Gondor's fading. Mm-hmm. These people in Gondor, where, you know, I mean, they've been so insulated at this point to where anything that could help their people against their enemies would seem a gift, no matter, you know, if it's good or evil. Like, they don't have a big grand outlook like Elrond, who's lived for 6,000 years, or Galadriel, who's lived for even longer, would have, or Gandalf either.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating observation. Like, and you could extend it even to the modern day. Like, what do you do when a culture doesn't have a historical reference point to understand something in context like that?
Right.
If they're in this culture that's somewhat cut off from its past, from its history, conceivably there's no one who knows these things and could share that, you know. And we could say the same for the hobbits, maybe, except that they luckily have Elrond and Gandalf and the wisest people in Middle Earth,
they're giving them sway,
right? Yeah. Giving them advice, wisdom. But let's say the hobbits by themselves, no Gandalf, no intervention, they would have no understanding either of what was to be done, right?
Right. And I mean, like you just said too, this is definitely a mistake that's happened in real history. Like, peoples and nations have made mistakes like this, and it definitely happened in the 20th century for sure.
Yeah,
without a doubt.
I mean, like,
you used evil weapons that were, you were trying to achieve good, but you use something that was just very evil.
Right. And then a more basic level, you can imagine any high school history teacher saying, like, kind of ranting about people who don't study their history and forgetting what's happened in the past.
Now, keeping on the track where it relates to us, you know, humans, when we read this story, we have to remember Boromir, he's the regular dude. He's a man. He's a human being. Aragorn, sure, he is too, but he's in line to be a king. He's descendant of the Men of Numenor, which are basically a step above us. Like, they're halfway to elves almost.
Right.
You know, so we can't really relate to Aragorn. By default, we have to relate to Boromir the most, which sucks, because look at this scene.
Absolutely. Like,
this sucks, you know? He's the one that betrays, and he's the one that falls into temptation the worst. You know, and what's the temptation that's exploited? It's his noble desire. It really is noble. It's a noble desire to gain the weapon to defend his homeland. And like we said, he's defending it against what? Literally pure evil. Even in that case, even against the pure evil, like we just said, you can't use an evil weapon to defeat evil, because you will become evil yourself. And in the real world, it's less justifiable, because the first step is you have to demonize other human beings or other groups of people to get to that point, which is like, I mean, that's just not right.
Well, and it's worth noting that towards the end of his speech, when Boromir breaks into tears, some people may view that as shallow after this, like, kind of betrayal of a monologue where we've, like, lost all faith in Boromir as a trustworthy character. You could also see his weeping as, like, he properly understands how far he's misstepped, and he wants to, like, repent for it, and he just doesn't, you know, he's too weak to undo what he's already, the mess he's already created.
I would say it's kind of like, you can't put toothpaste back in the tube once he did that. I mean, this is, you can be sorry, but this isn't correctable. I mean, Frodo ran away.
You definitely can't undo it, but it indicates for us that as a character, maybe he still has values, and it suggests to me that it redeems his character to the point where maybe he's a little naive about the power of the ring, but he's still well-intentioned within the world that he understands, and that part of his monologue is maybe pulled beyond what he would normally feel about the ring.
Okay, so that, let's TBD on that part.
Okay.
Too.
Okay.
Let's see whatever the next scene is with Boromir, and we'll see how he's acting there, and we can kind of assess there. I'd also note, though, it's very important to remember, Frodo was right in the middle. Like, he did not have the heart to basically choose to go east, to take the hard road. You know, like, that's what he was debating about. Like, he knows, okay, I can't really, you know, Minas Tirith, it's technically on the way, and it'd be nice to go there, and it'd be easier to go there. But, you know, the real debate is probably, I just have to go east. Mm-hmm. And this is actually the momentum that finally pushes him there. You know, like, that's what he says. Like, you misunderstand me. Like, yeah, my mind's made up. You misunderstand me. My mind is now made up because of looking at you. My mind's made up. I'm going east because this is a problem. Mm-hmm. I can't have this happen to all my friends around me. I'm going east. Okay, other big conversation based off this section. How is the ring affecting Boromir here in this chapter? There's two schools of thought, right? Because there's two schools of thought on evil in this book that we've gone over before, mm-hmm. right? We've seen the ring seem basically active, you know, like it betrays, it abandons people throughout the book and in The Hobbit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it convinces or pulls Frodo to put it on.
Mm-hmm. But when it comes down to it, I mean, it really is just a piece of metal. Like, it's not like it can actually do things, right? It's not like it's an animate being.
No, although we don't totally know to what extent this magic, what the powers mean, right? We know it makes Frodo invisible when he puts it on.
Well, yeah, I mean, it has powers, but it's not like it has an active will.
Yes. Although yes, I understand what you're saying. We have talked about the will of the ring, but we've...
All right, Clifford, let me just keep saying. Yeah. Okay. So now in this chapter here, so with Boromir, did just being near this ring this entire time for the whole fellowship, is that what's driving him mad here? Like, you know, did the ring actively drive him mad? Or did he drive himself mad because he's desiring it so bad? Or is it a combination of those two? Like, basically what I'm saying is, like, is the ring, like, actually a sentient creature that can make Boromir desire the ring? Or is it, as Tom Shippey calls, a psychic amplifier? Because you're just around it, your desire for it's amplified. Like, you know, everybody wants something like a nice shiny gold ring, but especially if it has powers to it. But is just being around it, like, does that amplify that?
I think it's somewhere in between the two, like you're suggesting.
Right.
Because it's hard to say that it's not having some undue effect on Boromir, just being present and knowing about it. On the other hand, he knows about it, so it's kind of working with his mind. So it's hard, you know, it's a little hard to disprove that it's just his mind obsessing over it that's what's made act out. But I think the way I read this section that we were just discussing, especially with him kind of falling into tears at the end, is that he's working himself up into a frenzy, motivated by the ring, amplified by the ring, like you suggest. That climax is where he's just totally obsessed, and then he snaps out of it, and he's able to, like, regain some of his composure. Not like he's suddenly immune from it, but he's able to kind of return to a more level-headed version of himself.
When I say sentient creature, like, let's be clear, that's kind of the view of evil where, you know, it's an external force that needs to be resisted, you know, like it was kind of the Manichaean view that we talked about, I think chapter 11 of the first book, mm-hmm. like the Weathertop chapter, right. Versus the psychic amplifier kind of falls more in that Boethian view, and that was the guy that's like, evil doesn't exist, it's just the absence of good.
Right.
Like, it's just...
The Manichaean view is kind of a dual good versus evil, right?
Right. And it, like, evil's like an active, it's a force that exists, and, you know, like, it's external, versus the amplifier, the psychic amplifier is more internal, mm-hmm. you know, and, like, absence of good, mm-hmm. you know? So that would be the difference there. Now, if what you're saying, that the ring had influence on him, how do you explain that... It doesn't seem to affect anybody else. I mean, maybe it affects Frodo, but I mean, that one's kind of obvious. But the rest of the fellowship seems good.
Well, as you mentioned just a few minutes ago, Boromir is the only man in this section besides Aragorn. And Aragorn is set apart. He's kind of in a category of his own. And that's reinforced by the way Tolkien describes him. You know, he's got these kind of weird mannerisms, and he's always kind of operating on a different wavelength from a lot of the other characters. Almost comically so at times. Which I think reinforces that he's, like, he's a man officially, but he's something different, basically. So Boromir, we don't have an apples-to-apples comparison for how it would affect another character. You know, like, we can reason that the elves are kind of perfect in their elven way and somehow are semi-immune, Legolas. Gimli, you know, maybe it's got some adverse effect on him. He just cares about different things. Same thing for the hobbits, you know?
Let me say this too. I was basically just asking that question more as a devil's advocate, really just to try to see both sides here. But we actually have probably seen instances where this ring has affected people. Like Galadriel is the first one that comes to mind. She was very tempted to actually take that thing. You know, like that was a big moment when she resisted taking that thing. So that had sway and temptation on her. I mean, Elrond, he saw it 3,000 years ago when Isildur had it, and he just knew it was bad news. So maybe he's over it. But it might have tempted Gandalf originally when Frodo was in Bag End with him. Possibly there. So I think...
And of all those characters you've just mentioned, we've learned from the Silmarillion that men are kind of the most corruptible.
Right. Yeah, so there's a good chance that it's affecting the other characters. It would just affect men the quickest. And so that's what we're seeing with Boromir here.
And layer that on with Boromir is the one perhaps most on the front lines, or at least feels like he's most on the front lines fighting evil, and therefore feels like he has the greatest need for the ring.
Right. I mean, it's definitely interesting. And, like, the interesting part, too, is, like, both these ideas, the active and the internal one, in ways, not perfectly, but in ways they both kind of line up with Christian ideas. Because, like, even the active idea, you know, like, that's basically saying, like, there's a supernatural demonic influence or temptation that's in this ring. And you see that all over scriptures, you know, like St. Paul and like St. Peter and Jesus himself in the Gospels, they're all saying like, you got to be vigilant. You got to be ready to actively resist evil, you know? And there's like prayers like the St. Michael prayer, like St. Michael, the Archangel, defend us in battle against the evils and snares of the devil. Like that, I mean, that's the first line. So, I mean, like this kind of stuff in Tolkien's theology, like this is real. What happened to Boromir here? This is the kind of stuff you pray to your guardian angel doesn't happen to you. You know, like this is what you pray the guardian angel protects you against, right? But then the Boethian idea of like evil is just the absence of good, it doesn't actually exist, that's probably more canonical too, you know, at the same time. Like that's like more so like that idea shows how much more powerful ultimately good is over evil, because like if evil doesn't exist and it's just the absence of good, I mean, it's like, well, what is it? It's like nothingness versus good, which is like the ultimate. You know, and in like real life, you know, God versus the devil, I mean, that's not even a contest. Like God's just wins. But yeah, like you said, Boromir, you know, he has the line like, a madness took me. And that's not him saying, oh, the devil made me do it. He does take responsibility. He understands he screwed up himself. But that doesn't mean there aren't other forces at work. You know, like that is implying that there are other forces at work.
Right.
Tom Pippy's got this good quote to kind of just sum this section up. The uncertainty over evil, in a way, dominates the entire structure of Lord of the Rings. All the characters would find decisions much easier if evil were unquestionably either the Boethian or else just Manichaean. If evil were only the absence of good, for instance, then the ring could never be anything other than a psychic amplifier. It would not betray its possessors, and all they would need to do is put it aside and think pure thoughts. However, if evil were merely a hateful and external power without echo in the hearts of the good, then someone might have to take the ring to the cracks of doom, but need not be Frodo. Gandalf could be trusted with it, while whoever went would only have to distrust his enemies, not his friends, and not himself.
Ultimately, I think we can kind of summarize, you put it very well, that the ring is a modern idea, and that absolute power corrupts absolutely is a pretty modern idea. This is a little bit of a fusion of the Manichaean and Boethian ideas about evil.
Yeah, fusion, or it's like a teeter-totter, like they're in tension about which one's actually real. And, you know, again, that's the beauty of it, is that, I don't know, they're kind of going to be in conflict the whole time, and we got to just keep reading on to see if we get any sort of conclusive evidence.
Right. Okay.
So anyways, Frodo ran away. He ends up running to the top of Aman Hen, which is that's this hill. And then he's in the ruin of like basically an old fortress. And then there's this big lofty seat atop it.
Up he went and sat upon the ancient chair, feeling like a lost child that had clambered upon the throne of mountain kings. At first, he could see little. He seemed to be in a world of mist in which there were only shadows. The ring was upon him. Then, here and there, the mist gave way and he saw many visions, clear and small as if they were under his eyes upon a table. And yet remote. There was no sound, only bright living images. The world seemed to have shrunk and fallen silent. He was sitting upon the seat of seeing, on Aman Hen, the hill of the eye of the men of Numenor. Eastward he looked into wide uncharted lands, nameless plains, and forests unexplored. Northward he looked, and the great river lay like a ribbon beneath him. and the misty mountains stood small and hard as broken teeth. Westward he looked and saw the broad pastures of Rohan and Orthanc, the pinnacle of Isengard, like a black spike. Southward he looked, and below his very feet the great river curled like a toppling wave and plunged over the falls of Raros into a foaming pit. A glimmering rainbow played upon the fume. And Aethir Anduin he saw, the mighty delta of the river, and myriads of seabirds whirling like white dust in the sun, and beneath them green and silver sea, rippling in endless lines. But everywhere he looked, he saw signs of war. The misty mountains were crawling like anthills. Orcs were issuing out of a thousand holes. Under the boughs of Mirkwood there was deadly strife of men and elves and fell beasts. The land of the Bjornings was aflame. A cloud was over Moria. Smoke rose on the borders of Lorien. Horsemen were galloping on the grass of Rohan. Wolves poured from Isengard. From the havens of Harad, ships of war put out to sea. And out of the east, men were moving endlessly. Swordsmen, spearmen, bowmen upon horses, chariots of chieftains and laden wains. All the power of the Dark Lord was in motion. Then, turning south again, he beheld Minas Tirith. Far away it seemed, and beautiful, white-walled, many-towered, proud and fair upon its mountain seat. Its battlements glittered with steel, and its turrets were bright with many banners. Hope leaped in his heart. But against Minas Tirith was set another fortress, greater and more strong. Thither, eastward, unwilling, his eye was drawn. It passed the ruined bridges of Osgiliath, the grinning gates of Minas Morgul, and the haunted mountains, and it looked upon Gorgoroth, the Valley of Terror in the land of Mordor. Darkness lay there under the sun. Fire glowed amid the smoke. Mount Doom was burning, and a great reek rising. Then at last his gaze was held. Wall upon wall, battlement upon battlement, black, immeasurably strong, mountain of iron, gate of steel, tower of adamant, he sought. Barad-dûr, fortress of Sauron. All hope left him.
And suddenly he felt the eye. There was an eye in the dark tower that did not sleep. He knew that it had become aware of his gaze. A fierce, eager will was there. It leapt towards him. Almost like a finger, he felt it, searching for him. Very soon it would nail him down, know just exactly where he was. Amon Law, it touched. It glanced upon Tolbrandir. He threw himself from the seat, crouching, covering his head with his gray hood. He heard himself crying out, "Never, never!" Or was it, "Verily I come. I come to you." He could not tell. Then, as a flash from some other point of power, there came to his mind another thought. Take it off! Take it off! Fool, take it off! Take off the ring! The two powers strove in him. For a moment, perfectly balanced between their piercing points, he writhed, tormented. Suddenly he was aware of himself again. Frodo, neither the voice nor the eye, free to choose, and with one remaining instant in which to do so. He took the ring off his finger. He was kneeling in clear sunlight before the high seat. A black shadow seemed to pass like an arm above him. It missed Amon-Hen and groped out westward and faded. Then all the sky was clean and blue birds sang in every tree. Frodo rose to his feet. A great weariness was on him, but his will was firm and his heart lighter. He spoke aloud to himself. "I will now do what I must," he said. "This, at least, is plain. The evil of the ring is already at work even in the company, and the ring must leave them before it does more harm. I will go alone. Some I cannot trust, and those I can trust are too dear to me. Poor old Sam, and Merry and Pippin. Strider, too. His heart yearns for Minas Tirith, and he will be needed there, now that Boromir has fallen into evil. I will go alone, at once." Big stuff.
Mm-hmm. Would you venture to say that this little paragraph right here is, like, almost a summary of the entire first two books of Lord of the Rings?
Well, this is why I think it's a good ending to this phase. Is this lays it all out. Everything's in motion. War's coming on everybody. Nobody's avoiding this conflict. This is basically like the World War of Middle Earth. And it sets up for the finale. I know we're only a third of the way through Lord of the Rings at this point, but we enter the final phase. Like, the first two books were actually more than just setup. Like, we're entering the finale now. Like, this is the finale of like the whole climax of the Rings history. He's seeing war everywhere, you know, like we went through a bunch of place names and geography. We're not going to go through it right now.
And just to be clear, he's seeing, this is not actually the view from Amon Hen. He's got a good view, but the ring is giving him some stronger powers.
It's amplifying it.
of seeing what's going on everywhere.
Right. And most notably, you know, he's seeing all the war to the north that they all pass through and how it's getting worse after they've gone through already. And then he's seeing what's near him in the east and the west. And then he even sees Boromir's city, Minas Tirith. And it's like, man, this is a cool looking city. It's really proud and it looks strong and defendable. But then he looks over and he sees the evil that's in Mordor. And then the lion that, I don't know, it sticks with me pretty well. All hope left him. And it's just like, yeah, it's like, that sucks. That's hard. But it's like, you know, you see Minas Morgul, you see this all of Mordor, and then you see this dark tower. And basically, you know, that in that line, all hope left him. What's happening there? He realizes, okay, this is just an impossible task. Look at how powerful the enemy is. Look at how much we've just been through this whole book, through this whole, you know, second half of the book, book two of with the Fellowship of the Ring. We've been through so much, and it was so hard. And, you know, now look at what we face here.
All the struggles they've been through so far. Looking south and east, it's like you ain't seen nothing yet.
Right. So, you know, they came through all this stuff, and then still, though, okay, well, this still looks unstoppable and inevitable that this much greater and superior force is going to win. Like, what are you supposed to do here? You know, and that gets at the whole history of Middle-earth. Like, think about all the history that Elrond and Galadriel and Gandalf have talked about before, and that expresses this. Now, in this vision, we get a visual now of it. You know, we've heard all the history, but now we see a visual of it in the Dark Tower in Mordor that... Okay, the good forces, they made progress at points, but it cost them a lot. And it was like at vast expenses to themselves, right? But evil has recuperated almost instantly and easily, you know, is what it looks like in this vision. It's like, all right, well, great. We went through all this hard stuff and now we got to face this tower. Like, this sucks.
Right. Well, and not to mention every direction he looks, he sees evil, the sort of the tendrils of evil.
Right. And so this again... Back to that history is one long defeat quote, you know, this is another influence on it. Like, he just sees this, and this is just kind of his natural view of evil.
Which, as a random side note, I feel like that lends itself a little bit more to the Boethian view of evil, where the
Manichaean one. Well, it's a thing.
No, I'm saying the Boethian one because, like, if you consider... I don't know if you remember from physics at all, the concept of entropy. It's like chaos in the structure of the world, both like within, you know, the earth and elsewhere. Entropy is always increasing. Chaos is always increasing. Like, as things grow more complex, they're also becoming more chaotic and broken down. And that's just a law of physics. And you can kind of take the same view of, like, goodness might exist all over the place, but if there's chaos and like the fracturing of goodness and the rise of evil everywhere, and it's like this unstoppable increase over time.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think like entropy, like what you're saying, might cut like a middle road between the two, but I think it's more so like, hey, there's all this evil and it is coming at us. Like, it's the external kind of thing with the Manichaean view. Yeah, because it's not like it's an absence of something. It's like, this is real. We can see
I guess I should rephrase this specific section where Frodo's looking around and seeing everything. Definitely very active and more Manichaean. I could interpret Tolkien's quote in the abstract as being more Boethian, where we're describing it as like it's kind of this abstract, unstoppable increase that maybe is punctuated by events to the contrary.
Well, yeah, so this sets up the next point, though. So, evil seems unstoppable. So what's going on here? Is he just, like, kind of a defeatist person that you should just give up?
Well, no, he's got these kind of the voices on his shoulders, basically.
Well, not so much even to the voices yet. I mean, in general, no, obviously not, because they've known the odds are stacked against them since at least the Council of Elrond, right? And they were saying, like, well, we're just going to try to go for a last-ditch secret mission effort, right? Even though that seems impossible, and Boromir's basically... Like, Boromir's resigned thinking it's suicide himself. Definitely not defeatist, because defeatist is, like, especially, like, World War One kind of... The French word...
Defeatisme?
Defeatisme? Defeatisme. That probably sounds more right. Defeatisme, like, in... I guess in World War One, that was like the term that the French had, because they were basically just giving in to war weariness and sacrifices that they'd already made, and they just wanted to abandon it and just have inconclusive peace or whatever. You know, just like, just settle. Whatever's going on, just settle. And Tolkien, absolutely against that. You know, he had a bunch of friends died in World War One. He fought in World War One. He didn't want that to just end with like no
result, you know, worth anything.
Right.
So what's he doing here with the theory of evil? Here's what he's trying to do, according to Tom Shippey, and this is a really cool idea. So what he's trying to do is he's trying to reintroduce the theory of courage. Tolkien says this is the greatest contribution that the North, so that's like kind of Norse stuff, made to humanity.
Hmm.
Okay. So for them, in the final battle at the end of time, which is, you might have heard of like Ragnarok, mm-hmm. there's that crappy Thor movie called Ragnarok. Don't acknowledge it. That's a 3 out of 10 movie. Don't acknowledge it. So in that, evil wins and the gods are destroyed. Like, that's what's going to happen. Like, all the gods, like, you know, you're thinking Odin and Thor, they're all going to line up for this big battle against all the evil giants and, like, fire monsters and everything. That's what, like, the fire monsters are what the Balrogs based off of. So think about, like, all the gods taking on, like, monsters like the Balrogs. And they're going to lose. And they're going to get destroyed. And they know that in advance. So, like, why would anybody join the gods team? Like, why would men be interested in that? Like, why do that at all?
Mm-hmm.
This is the great contribution, is that they do fight on for that. According to Shippey, Tolkien says the answer is, victory or defeat have nothing to do with right and wrong. And that even if the universe is controlled beyond redemption by hostile and evil forces, that is not enough to make a hero change sides. In a sense, this northern mythology asks more of people than Christianity does, for it offers them no heaven, no salvation, no reward for virtue, except the somber satisfaction of having done right. Tolkien wanted his characters in Lord of the Rings to live up to the same high standard, and was careful, therefore, to remove easy hope from them. Pretty cool, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
That's yeah, clearly evident throughout everything we've read with Frodo and then with the elves as well.
Yeah, exactly, with the elves. Definitely with the elves.
Yeah, what's also interesting, though, is that I feel like Boromir is also fairly exemplary of this northern Norse mentality, just in a different way, you know, as we discussed, because he's got this different worldview coming from Gondor, but he's basically espousing the same thing, where he's like, no, we're probably going to lose, but we fight anyways, and we'll go valiantly, which I think makes it all the more nuanced and complex when, as far as discussing the corruption of Boromir.
I think Boromir still is slightly holding out hope, that like actual hope that they overcome and win. But I think he thinks the only way it's tied to is the ring itself. Like, we need to use the ring to defend ourselves.
Okay.
Anyways, with this, though, I think you're totally right that the elves feel this, but this doesn't line up with Christian theology at all, and it didn't line up with Tolkien's worldview. Also, I personally just have, like, a couple of problems, or, like, one kind of big problem with this is, like, how do the good guys, so, like, the Norse gods, like Odin and Thor, how do they know what's right? The stories that I've heard, that like, the folk tales that go with these Norse gods, mm-hmm. I don't think they sound like perfect people. So I don't really know how they justify, you know, doing what's right, like, how they're on the good side, the right side. But I'm totally on board with that, like the idea, the heroic idea that you fight the good fight, even though you know you're literally, there's literally no hope of victory for it. But again, this doesn't line up with Christian ideas about what happens at the end of time. Because at the end of time, sure, you know, like you could have like a metaphorical battle or something, but you know, good wins out, right? You know, and just any way you slice it, even though I don't even know if there's really a big battle at the end of time or whatever. Anyways, more importantly, too, by the 1940s, when this is being written, his whole society didn't have this Ragnarok idea either. That Christian idea of just like some sort of happy ending is totally entrenched, too. You know, like everybody thinks like that. So he wants to rebring in a new image of like ultimate bravery, and he liked the Ragnarok one, but it doesn't line up with his personal theology, and it doesn't line up with what anybody else thinks of like bravery or anything. So he needs something else. I think we'll see the kind of the fruition of this at the end of this chapter.
Okay.
But yeah, we can move on a little bit here.
Okay.
Voices on the shoulder. It almost seems like the, you know, the devil and the angel on the shoulder, right, for the rest of this.
Right. It was a little bit weird, though. What, you know, he mentions suddenly he was aware of himself again. Frodo, neither the voice nor the eye being the eye of Sauron, we can assume is the devil on the shoulder. But then this voice was not described very clearly.
Yeah.
Does it seem like this other voice is really pulling him to clarity or resistance? Because ultimately I felt like Frodo himself, neither the voice nor the eye, is the one who makes the decision to pull the ring off, which is ultimately the right decision.
I think that other voice clears him up and gives him allowance to make the choice himself.
Okay.
But then again, it's like, well, if it gives him allowance like that, is he really making the free choice himself afterwards? Which is, I mean, that's like the whole conflict here. What the powers are that are striving within the context of Lord of the Rings itself, we will determine later once we actually know, because it's just not clear yet, and I don't want to spoil it.
Okay.
All right, so like we said, kind of at the end of it, he kind of decided, okay, I got to go by myself, leave. Nobody can come with me. I just got to do this because this ring's going to affect everybody else. So his plan is he's going to put the ring on again, and he's going to Irish goodbye everybody.
Well, wait, real quick, before we get to that, do you feel like, was it Boromir was the impetus for his decision, or did coming up to the top of the hill, seeing the Eye of Sauron, and experiencing the kind of brush with, not quite brush with death, but brush with vision with the Eye of Sauron, that led to his decision?
I think Boromir was the impetus to say, yes, I'm going east, pure and simple. But the seeing the eye says, hey, I don't want to bring anybody else with me because this is an impossible mission.
Okay.
So Tolkien then jumps back to the whole fellowship group while they're waiting for Frodo to decide.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever small talk they keep having, it always just comes back to the choice of which way are they going. And Legolas and Gimli, it sounds like they want to go to the Minas Tirith, but they're going to follow Frodo wherever he goes. And everybody has the same idea. Like, they're all pretty loyal to him. Aragorn himself thinks they should probably split up. And Frodo, Sam, Gimli, maybe Legolas, and Aragorn himself, they all go east with Frodo. And then Boromir and probably the other two hobbits probably go south with Boromir to Minas Tirith. And they all kind of agree going east is like a suicide mission.
Right.
But they're still willing to go, especially since this is Frodo's task.
Right.
Merry says, what does Merry say? You want to take what Merry says?
Yeah. It seemed different so far away, in the Shire or in Rivendell. It would be mad and cruel to let Frodo go to Mordor, said Merry. Why can't we stop him?
We must stop him, said Pippin, and that is what he's worrying about, I'm sure. He knows that we shan't agree to his going east, and he doesn't like to ask anyone to go with him. Poor old fellow. Imagine it, going off to Mordor alone? Pippin shuddered. But the dear silly old hobbit, he ought to know that he shan't got to ask. He ought to know that if we can't stop him, we shan't leave him.
Begging your pardon, said Sam, I don't think you understand my master at all. He isn't hesitating about which way to go. Of course not. What's the good of Minas Tirith anyway? To him, I mean, begging your pardon, Master Boromir, he added, and turned. It was then that they discovered that Boromir, who had at first been sitting silent on the outside of the circle, was no longer there. Now where's he got to? Cried Sam, looking worried. He's been a bit queer lately, to my mind. But anyways, he's not in this business. He's off to his home, as he always said, and no blame to him. But Mr. Frodo, he knows he's got to find the cracks of doom if he can, but he's afraid. Now it's come to the point, he's just plain terrified. That's what his trouble is. Of course he's had a bit of schooling, so to speak. We all have, since we left home. Or he'd just be so terrified he'd just fling the ring into the river and bolt. But he's still too frightened to start, and he isn't worrying about us either, whether we'll go along with him or no. He knows we mean to. That's another thing that's bothering him. If he screws himself up to go, he'll want to go alone. Mark my words. We're going to have trouble when he comes back. He'll screw himself up all right, as sure as his name's Baggins.
I believe you speak more wisely than any of us, Sam, said Aragorn. That's pretty cool. I really love that, because Sam, he's totally laser-focused right. Like, that's, he's dead on, and Aragorn acknowledges it, and then just the fact that Sam's the wisest of everybody, I love it.
And it's yet another part in this this moment in this chapter where you just get this, like, moment of total clarity.
Yep.
That we've seen at a few other points that has sort of been lacking, or at least there's always been something fuzzy going throughout the rest of the two books so far.
Yeah, I think you're right. But it's been lacking for the most recent chapters, more so because nobody just had the courage to just go east and like jump in, you know,
fully. And they're missing Gandalf, who is always the voice of reason.
I mean, Gandalf was committed to going into Mordor with Frodo. He didn't quite even know the way. Like, they're basically deciding between one more huge rest stop or going on. Sam knows, like, hey, we have to go on. We can't take any sort of easier road here. We just got to go the hard road. But, you know, Pippin still wants to stop him. But Aragorn has that line, I do not think that our part is to drive him one way or the other, nor do I think that we should succeed if we tried. There are other powers at work far stronger. So this, again, goes back to the idea that Aragorn's kind of waiting for some sort of fate or something else to, like, decide what way he's going on this. He wants something to decide the routes for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at this point that Boromir returns, and it's notable that he's sad and grim. He doesn't even make eye contact with everybody. So it does seem to me like he's very embarrassed and he's saddened by what he's done. He knows he screwed up, and when I say screwed up, like, he knows he sinned.
Yeah, and he comes back with his tail between his legs. Yeah. And everyone quickly realizes something's wrong.
Well, let's be clear what he says here. So he admits that he talked to Frodo. He says he got angry with him. And he says that Frodo put on the ring and ran away. Aragorn's staring him down. Sam just, you know, already the most clear thinking here in this whole scene. He's pissed and distraught because of that. Like, he knows, like, okay, Boromir did something and this screwed up. And from there, Sam and the hobbits basically just go bolting off, and they're going to look for Frodo. Aragorn wants to do, like, search for Frodo in an organized way, but Sam's just super panicked and everything. And there's the line, "A sudden panic or madness seemed to have fallen on the company."
"We shall all be scattered and lost," groaned Aragorn. "Boromir, I do not know what part you have played in this mischief, but help now. Go after those two young hobbits and guard them at least, even if you cannot find Frodo. Come back to this spot if you find him or any traces of him. I shall return soon."
Right, because Sam's basically sensing, like, Frodo's getting out of here without saying goodbye, and so, like, they all need to find Frodo now because they all want to go with them. You know, Aragorn's had all these weird feelings and stuff. There's something strange going on, and, like, that's continuing here. Like, everybody's just going their own separate ways, and there's no order or organization to it. So Aragorn goes, catches Sam, and again, they quote, there's a quote saying, like, Aragorn senses mischief about. And he does, like you said at the beginning of the episode, he does want to sit on the seat of seeing to maybe clear his mind and give him counsel about what to do. So Aragorn's running up. Sam cannot keep up with him because he doesn't have, like, the big legs like a tall man, right? Sam, again, clear thinking guy in this chapter. What does he do? You want to take his lines there?
"Whoa, Sam Gamgee," he said aloud. "Your legs are too short, so use your head. Let me see now. Boromir isn't lying. That's not his way. But he hasn't told us everything. Something scared Mr. Frodo badly. He screwed himself up to the point, sudden. He made up his mind at last. To go. Where to? Off east. Not without Sam? Yes. Without even his Sam. That's hard. Cruel hard."
Sam passed his hands over his eyes, brushing away the tears.
"Study, Gamgee," he said. "Think if you can. He can't fly across rivers, and he can't jump waterfalls. He's got no gear. So he's got to get back to the boats. Back to the boats. Back to the boats, Sam, like lightning."
So then, obviously, now Sam's definitely figured it all out. He runs back to the camp. He's hearing cries in the woods, but he ignores them. He sees a boat moving in the water by itself. So obviously, Frodo's probably wearing the ring, and he's got it. For this big final part, I'll be Sam, because Clifford's too calm. So Clifford can be Frodo.
Okay.
So, "Coming, Mr. Frodo, coming," called Sam, and he flung himself from the bank, clutching at the departed boat. He missed it by a yard. With a cry and a splash, he fell face forward into the deep, swift water. Gurgling, he went under, and the river closed under his curly head.
An exclamation of dismay came from the empty boat. A paddle swirled, and the boat put about. Frodo was just in time to grasp Sam by the hair as he came up, bubbling and struggling. Fear was staring in his round brown eyes. "Up you come, Sam, my lad," said Frodo. "Now take my hand."
"Save me, Mr. Frodo," gasped Sam. "I'm drowned, and I can't see your hand."
"Here it is. Don't pinch, lad. I won't let you go. Tread water and don't flounder, or you'll upset the boat. There now, get a hold of the side, and let me use the paddle." With a few strokes, Frodo brought the boat back to the bank, and Sam was able to scramble out, wet as a water rat. Frodo took off the ring and stepped ashore again. "Of all the confounded nuisances, you are the worst, Sam," he said.
"Oh, Mr. Frodo, that's hard," said Sam, shivering. "That's hard. Trying to go without me and all. If I hadn't guessed right, where would you be now?"
"Safely on my way."
"Safely," said Sam. "All alone and without me to help you? I couldn't have borne it. It had been the death of me."
"It would have been the death of you to come with me, Sam," said Frodo, "and I could not have borne that."
"Not as certain as being left behind," said Sam.
"But I am going to Mordor."
"I know that well enough, Mr. Frodo. Of course you are, and I'm coming with you."
"Now, Sam," said Frodo, "don't hinder me. The others will be coming back any minute. If they catch me here, I shall have to argue and explain, and I shall never have the heart or chance to get off. But I must go at once. It's the only way."
"Of course it is," answered Sam, "but not alone. I'm coming too, or neither of us is going. I'll knock holes in all the boats first."
Frodo actually laughed. A sudden warmth and gladness touched his heart. "Leave one," he said. "We'll need it. but you can't come like this without your gear or food or anything.
Just a moment, and I'll go get my stuff, cried Sam eagerly. It's all ready. I thought we should be off today. He rushed to the camping place, fished out his pack from the pile where Frodo had laid it when he emptied the boat of his companion's goods, grabbed a spare blanket and some extra packages of food, and ran back.
So my plan is all spoilt, said Frodo. It is no good trying to escape you. But I'm glad, Sam. I cannot tell you how glad. Come along. It is plain that we are meant to go together. We will go, and may the others find a safe road. Strider will look after them. I don't suppose we shall see them again.
We may yet, Mr. Frodo. We may yet, said Sam. Okay, iconic moment. Mm-hmm. Obviously had to read, obviously. Okay, so off the bat, challenge. Name an example in literally the entirety of literature or history where somebody has been as loyal as Sam is here. I really can't name one.
Well, I would temper that. Sam's definitely being very loyal, but I think that this is a step short of, like, you know, sacrificing himself for Frodo.
No. I think it's better than that because Frodo knows he is going to the worst place imaginable. He's going to the center of hell. And Sam is literally going to go with him. It's not like he's just going to give emotional support. Like, I was thinking, like, St. John and Mary, they come to Jesus when he's nailed to the cross, which is, like, up there for worst things imaginable, right? But they can't go with him to where he's going to go when he dies. You know, like they can only just emotionally be there to see his earthly end. They don't mm-hmm. know what he does afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But here, Sam's like, no, we're going together. You know, like, whatever you're going to do, I'm going to do with you.
I still see it, though, as at best, Sam is fully conscious that he's sacrificing himself, walking down a road of no return, also understanding that Frodo may be too. So he's, like, in a very abstract way, he's sacrificing himself for the potential that he might be helping Frodo. But still, I feel like it's tempered by the fact that he still wants to go with his friend. He doesn't want to leave Frodo's side. So he's extremely loyal. But his action...
Yeah, but he's doing it all for Frodo's sake. It's not like he needs to be with Frodo.
No, certainly.
He wants to be with Frodo so that he can protect him.
Right. I'm saying that it could be driven, even if he's conscious of the long-term consequences, driven more by the short-term, you know, recognition of, like, no, I gotta stick with my friend. I can't let him go alone over the long-term, like, I'm gonna walk down this path of no return with Frodo.
Okay, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. No, but I disagree. At this point, they know the full weight of what they're going into. Like, everybody's aware that it's a suicide mission because everybody wants to go to Minas Tirith. The only person that didn't was Sam because he knows it's just counterproductive.
Mm-hmm.
Even Aragorn mm-hmm. wanted to go to Minas Tirith.
Like, well, that's what I mean is that almost serves to back up what I'm saying is, like, Sam has a rational basis for supporting Frodo, and he's, like, he's already willing to be very loyal and, you know, not have any personal concerns or hesitation to help out his master, as he refers to him. But still, I think he's driven by, like, this rational present desire to help and support Frodo as much as he is driven by this longer term, more abstract desire to sacrifice himself for Frodo.
Okay. A little bit more on Sam here. I don't think we've actually talked about the inspirations for Sam yet. I think this is a very opportune place to do it. Tolkien explicitly says in some sort of letter, he says, "My Sam Gamgee is indeed a reflection of the English soldier, of the privates and batmen I knew in the 1914 war and recognized as so far superior to myself."
The privates in what?
The batmen. So what is a Batman? It's not a superhero.
So what's a Batman?
Okay, so Batman... The best example I found in the reading was from Tolkien in the Great War, page 171, if anybody has the edition I have. Anyways, let me just quote this. "The Batman performed domestic chores for the officer." So this is, like, basically they were the right-hand man of, like, any sort of officer. And if you had a high level of education, you just entered the war as an officer instead of just, like, a grunt private.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that meant you were in command of soldiers. Okay. "The Batman performed domestic chores for the officer, making his bed, tidying and polishing, and furnishing his table with the best. This was a practical arrangement, not just a luxury. Officers undoubtedly held a cushier life than the other ranks, but they had little time to spare from training, directing working parties, and, on off days, in quotes, censoring the men's inevitable letters home, a deeply divisive and unpopular duty. A resourceful Batman And I feel like they didn't actually say, like, Batman, like how we say it. Like, somehow they would make it, like, one syllable. I don't know how to do that. So, Batman. Maybe Batman? Mm-hmm. Batman. Batman. Okay. A resourceful Batman could win a great deal of gratitude and respect. Token, who found it hard to warm to his fellow officers, developed a profound admiration for the Batman he knew. However, the Batman was not primarily a servant, but a private soldier who acted as a runner for officers in action. As such, he had to be both fit and intelligent so that he did not garble the orders or reports. Like any other private, he also fought in the field. Right off the bat, just from that description, I think it's kind of clear to see the influence of those kinds of the loyal servant that you see in Sam. What do you think?
Makes a lot of sense. I'm still a little bit confused. Tolkien was a private.
No, he was an officer.
Oh, okay. He was an officer and he probably had
a Batman.
A Batman kind of as his almost his secretary or something. His support.
Off duty it's a secretary. On duty it's kind of like your bodyguard, also your messenger runner.
Understood. And he's expressing his sincere admiration for these guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was very impressed by them.
Yeah, I mean, we see that in Sam. He's intensely loyal, but also super sharp. And Frodo certainly depends on him, even if he doesn't acknowledge it. But Sam is sort of like a font of knowledge about the weather and random things, as we've discussed before, and then kind of common sense logic a lot of times. So I could totally see the same sort of banter and exchanges happening in World War One battle setting.
Yeah. Okay, so like I said, he was trying to create like a new version of the theory of courage, a new Ragnarok for the modern world, like you're just gonna fight the good fight even though it ends in defeat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what he starts doing here. The new ultimate image of bravery that he comes up with, he wanted to make one that has meaning for the modern world. Even though at this point, by like 1940, that was out of fashion. You almost even liked the unheroic or the anti-hero. So in Lord of the Rings, he solves that with the hobbits. He was developing this with Bilbo and the hobbit itself. But now this time, it's not just one solitary hobbit that's doing all this stuff. They're usually found in pairs, and the image of courage that they project has a more social element about it. It is centered unexpectedly on laughter, cheerfulness, and added, which far from speculating about its chances on doomsday, refuses to ever look into the future at all. Like, think back to just the end of this conversation here. Frodo laughs, like, actually laughs. Like, when I read that line, I find that one of the most heartwarming lines of the whole book that we've read so far. I don't know if you agree, but like that just like it does strike me whenever you read it. It's like Frodo actually laughed. You know, it's like what was happening 10 minutes ago? Frodo was staring down the Dark Tower and the impossible mission that they have, and now Sam's cracking him up and he's laughing.
Right.
That's encouraging and heartwarming. And so, I mean, we're not really getting to the heart of how the hobbits embrace, I don't know, the Northern or the Ragnarok ideals. We'll have to see how this develops in the next two books, but we can start to be aware of it here. You know, like even at the end here, Frodo's saying, I don't suppose we'll ever see them again. And, you know, them is like the rest of the fellowship. But Sam's like, we may yet, you know, but let's not worry about it. You know, like, let's just duck our heads, keep plowing along, you know, like let's just go for this, you know.
Mm-hmm,
And just do what we can, you know. So like refuses to ever look into the future. It's like that's true, like this is happening right as we're looking at this.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal kind of summary to that. Although I another reading that I kind of envision with that is like Frodo's got this Ragnarok courage mentality where he's like, I'm walking to my death. And like I'm coming to terms with it. Sam is font of endless optimism. You could correct me, but I feel like more of a Christian worldview, where he's still somewhere in the back of his mind is like understands goodness and evil in the context of like ultimate salvation or something.
I disagree because we saw in this chapter, Sam is the clearest thinking person here for somehow.
Uh-huh.
Like throughout this whole chapter, he's the clearest thinking. Like, Frodo sat on the seat and he has all these visions of the evil that's coming and everything. Mm-hmm. But I think it's unfair to say Sam is just naive about what's coming forward and like he's holding out some before hope. I think he's in the same exact boat as Frodo because he guessed.
I'm not saying he's naive though. I'm saying he's optimistic because he has faith in it. In a alternate ending that might be against all odds, but he's still...
Where's the evidence of that, though?
Because he's saying the we may yet see them again. I feel like you could read that as, like, not just a offhanded comment in response, like, like saying ho-hum to Frodo's statement, and more of a, like, I wouldn't be so sure of yourself, Mr. Frodo. Like, I do feel like we might win this thing against all odds.
I would say that will have to be determined.
Okay.
We're introducing this now. We got two books to look over this part, like this theme. See what develops here.
Yeah.
As we get details, we'll call it out.
I will use this as my first chance to introduce one of my opinions that is maybe a little bit unpopular, but I don't like Frodo that much from this point on, and Sam continues to prove himself as, in my opinion, a better character. But we can touch on that later on.
Yeah, I'm going to cut that out. I think that's way too preemptive, Clifford. Okay. There's going to be a whole book. There's going to be half a book of no Frodo and Sam.
Okay.
And I think you also have too much of a movie vision. Frodo's much better in the book here. Anyways, though, it ends with them successfully rowing across the river. They hide the boat, and they start walking into the Emyn Muil, and that's how the book ends. All right, so we got a couple draft notes that I want to go over. I know we're, like, already long on time, but let me just do this, because this is kind of interesting versus what actually happens, especially if people know what happens. But we're not going to spoil what's going to come in the next recent chapters. So when he was writing the farewell to Lorien, he started making substantial outlines about what was to come and everything. So he's drafting these things, and he comes up with, okay, Boromir's going to confront Frodo and try to take the ring from him. So in the outlines, Boromir will come back, and Sam and everyone will figure out that he did something to set Frodo off, and everyone loses it and goes searching for Frodo. That is actually what happens. So, okay, so that part of the outline is good. Now, in the original outline, Frodo is going to run away and does successfully get away, and Sam, solo, is going to have to go and follow him in another boat across the river and then eventually track him down, maybe even with help. Meanwhile, Trotter, Legolas, Gimli, and Boromir will come back to the camp after everyone goes wild, and they won't find any of the four hobbits, and they're all gone. And, like, there was even the idea that Legolas and Gimli would be so discouraged that they would actually just throw in the towel and just start heading home north, which absolutely doesn't line up with what they were saying in this chapter. Like, they were committed to going with Frodo, right? But apparently that outline also says something, and I didn't even read it clearly enough, and I also don't want to use it because it might spoil what's coming, but apparently Legolas and Gimli would probably meet someone on their way back, and they would probably change their course and go back. Who knows? Merry and Pippin would also get lost, and they would meet somebody else that would set their storyline up. That's kind of accurate, so I'm not going to say any more about it. And then the plan is that Boromir is to go home to Minas Tirith for some great siege and big battle, and there he'd actually end up being a traitor as well there, too. So, like, he would become, like, a real evil guy, which is, like, oh, that sucks. He has ideas for, like, the characters that go east, you know, Frodo and Sam. No point to talk about that now, because I don't want to spoil anything. But as he's writing this chapter, like the actual draft for this chapter, so not just an outline, he starts adding the last scene where Sam sees the boat leaving and he tries to swim after it. And then, like, you know, him and Frodo go off together. So he abandons the idea where Sam has to track down Frodo. And then at this point, that's when he sets down the new, I'd say, in quotes, correct outlines of what most of the characters go on to do in the published work. And those ideas change significantly, which is kind of interesting that he didn't come to those ideas until he was literally writing it out. For anybody that knows the story, it's like, yeah, he didn't expect what happens in this time until he wrote it out himself. Like, the outlines were clearly projecting something else. Just a heads up, we'll see once we start the next book what that means.
Okay.
Okay, well, Clifford, we come to the end. Exciting stuff. Now we can finally get into it. I remember I convinced my dad, I convinced you, I convinced many other people to read Lord of the Rings. I don't have enough fingers to count how many people I've convinced to read the whole books all the way through.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. For a good track record as a LOTR evangelist.
Thanks. Anyways, though, I remember when my dad was reading the books. He trucks through the last few chapters of the Fellowship one night, And he walks downstairs, and he says he feels like the end's anticlimactic. He just goes on and he says, I get to the end of this thing, and there's no ending at all. Then I realize I have to read all of this stuff, you know? and apparently, I've heard, this is how some people felt in the theater, too, and it just fades to black when they're walking into the MMA wheel, and it's just like, that's it? You know, like, people booed. I don't know. I don't remember, because I didn't see it in theaters. Mm-hmm. I was too young. But I don't know. I personally disagree. Like, I think this is a good ending, especially when you keep in lens that this is just the end of one part of a great larger work,
right?
And it's not three separate books. It's literally just divided in there for printing purposes, almost.
Right, and for lack of a better term, like, this first third is the boring third. Got all the setup, and even though it's not an action focus, the most important thing that happens in this entire third, these entire two books, is the understanding of the journey and Frodo deciding to take the ring and embarking on that journey, right? Yeah, I mean, the formation of the Fellowship more broadly, but this chapter does actually reconcile all those things. Like, it doesn't feel like some big action scene, but Frodo finally making this decision and setting off, really beginning his personal odyssey to destroying the ring, not just going along with the crowd. That's come full circle.
Like I said, we're only a third of the way through the books, but the time span of Two Towers is so much shorter compared to Fellowship. Like, technically, Fellowship, there's been 17 years technically that's passed, maybe 18 mm-hmm. by this point. Because, you know, there's a 17-year gap when Bilbo leaves from chapter 1 to chapter right. 2. But anyways, even that, there's still months gap in this. The other two books, the timeline's much shorter. So they are actually at the final phase, especially if you looked at how much ground they've covered from the Shire to this point, and then how little left they have. Not to say it's nothing, by no means, you know. Mm-hmm. If anything, it's like, this is the hardest part, but they are at the finale, or like, this is like the big selection. Mm-hmm. To use a bike racing term, like, this is the final group, you know, and this mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. now this is the big push, and this is the finale coming up, you know.
Right.
Plus, I think, like, sitting in the chair and seeing everything, it's like, that's a good lay of the land, you know, before the ending here. You know, you get the Fate's kind of intervening that the Fellowship's going to break up here. You know, like Aragorn was waiting for some sort of way to figure out what to do, and it's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, like, out of his control, which is almost even somewhat what he kind of hoped for or expected, maybe.
Right.
And so that's happening. And so Frodo and Sam are going to do this. Everybody else is going to do something else. We don't know what everybody else is going to do. That's what book three is about.
Mm-hmm.
So I would also say, too, just from a podcast producing perspective, super satisfying to get to this point. Unbelievably nice that I will not have to look at the huge Lord of the Rings notes outline that I have of, like, so, like, all the supplementary books that we quote and everything, I have these quotes somewhat laid out in one big outline.
Uh-huh.
And I just have to keep putting all my ideas and references there. It's gonna be so nice when I only have to look at a Two Towers and a Return of the King outline, as opposed to all three. I mean, this is, we're cutting off like a 40 or 50 page document here. So it's like,
that's
great. I don't have to look at it anymore. It's so nice. Don't have to scroll down or anything like that. It was awesome.
Congratulations.
Well, congrats to you too. I mean, you're part of this too. Yeah.
Okay. So the rankings took a little bit longer than we expected. So we just decided to break it off and make it its own little mini episode. So it'll be coming out soon, probably within a couple of days here. Thanks. Talk to you guys later.
Thanks, y'all.